the mathematical aspects of quantum field theory. So we're going to kind of follow my book on normalization. We're going to start like pretty basic with finite dimensional path integrals and Feynman diagrams, just to make sure everybody's on the same page. We'll eventually, eventually we'll start treating homological techniques like the BV formalism. But at first, we're not going to do that at all. We're going to stick to simpler things like scalar field theories, fermionic field theories, renormalization, renormalization group flow, and this kind of thing. So to start with today, I want to discuss just basics about Feynman diagram expansions. So, we're going to consider integrals on Rn. Integrating some function against some quadratic form. Yeah, so this is some symmetric matrix. His determinant is 1, or at least plus or minus 1. So the Feynman diagram expansion writes this expression as a sum over diagrams. But the way I like to write it is there's an entirely algebraic way to rewrite this integral by using the propagator. So we let Pij be such that Pij, Ajk is delta ik. And then we can consider a differential operator, which I'll write del sub p. This is the sum Pij ddxi dxj. And the first claim from which the Feynman diagrams will follow, which we'll use a lot, is the following. The integral over Rn of some function is the same thing as I apply this differential operator to f, and then you evaluate at x equals 0. Okay, so here we have some differential operator. So we exponentiate it, so we're going to be differentiating some large number of times. We apply it to this function, and then you want to pick out the constant term. So what you want to think is that this is a polynomial some degree, and every time I hit it with some term in the exponential, I'm lowering the degree. So this whole expression is just, it doesn't involve any infinite sums. It's just a finite sum of terms. Okay, so some people might be familiar with this already. So I think the physicist's way to prove this would be to say, well, let's look at both sides and let's Fourier transform. The Fourier transform of the integral becomes the evaluation. And you play around a bit like that. The Fourier transform of this Gaussian becomes a Gaussian built on the Fourier dual variables, which looks like that, and so on. But we can just prove this very easily by integration by parts. It's just a little piece of algebra. And maybe just to make things clear, if A, this matrix, is just delta ij, then this operator is sum is a Laplacian. As a sum del xi squared, and we're saying zero. Okay, so how do we prove something like this? So as I said, I want to prove it by integration by parts. And then we'll see why this leads to the usual Feynman diagrammatics, but it's a useful expression in itself, and we're going to be using it a lot. So we note that we take our integral, and I'm going to differentiated with respect to something. I'm going to differentiate it with respect to P K L del XL. So of course, this is zero. And now, well, we bring this in here, we get a sum of two terms. So the first term is when this guy hits there, so then I'll get minus E K L A L J X J. And for the other term, I'll get plus EKL del XLF. Now you notice that this guy, his X, is just XK. Minus XK. Plus EKL LXLF. And that this is equal to zero. So let's now check that the other one satisfies the same identity, and then we'll know that they must be the same, up to some normalization given by what they do to the function one. And we're generally not concerned with that, the normalizing factor. Now similarly, we can ask what is e to the half del xi, del xj, pij. And I'm going to put in some xk to compare it with this guy. Well, what I can do is if I move this xk past everything, then I'll get zero, because I'm evaluating at zero. But when I move it past, I'll pick up a term where I differentiate it once. Oh, thank you. So this guy is equal to, I move it past, I'll get p, exactly the same thing, pkl del xl f. And then, so this, bringing this to the other side, they satisfy the same equation. So this tells us that if f is a polynomial, the two quantities must agree, because I can use these rules to reduce it to the case when f is constant. So, you know. Okay, so some inductive argument will now let us see that this guy, the thing over here with the integral, must be the thing over there with the exponential. Any questions about that? As I said, you can also prove it using the Fourier transform. So does this piece of algebra make sense to people, or more details required? So like maybe to be super concrete, concretely, if we had something like if we had this integral times a polynomial, I would use integration by parts to say, well, I can take x1 here can be realized by having a d by dx1 over here. So this is the same as x1 to the n minus 1 with some differential. Then I bring it over here, and I've reduced this thing by 2. And I keep playing this game until I've gotten rid of these guys, introduced some factorials, some constants, and reduce it to the case when I integrate against 1 times some constants. And I'm normalizing the measure so that this is 1. And similarly, with the other guy, I would do exactly the same thing. I would have e to the half sum del x I squared times x1 n1 xm nm. I evaluate this at 0. Well, how do I compute this? I move one thing across. I pick up an extra derivative, it hits this guy, and I keep on moving a single xi across to the other side. And as I do that, I'll pick up some constants, and I'm reduced at the end to just 1 times the constants I've picked up. And these prefactors are the same. That's what we've just deduced, because they satisfy the same algebraic rules. Sorry, I think this is probably the most cryptic proof of the like Wick's lemma ever, but I don't know. I kind of like this argument. How does this argument tell us about the Feynman diagrams? Well, so let's consider this expression, say. Let's consider applying this exponentiated differential operator to some polynomial. Call this expression. So I'm going to draw a picture, say F has K, so it has this degree. So we draw it as this kind of thing. And there's k external lines. Now, suppose I was to differentiate f with this operator just once, let me think if this is the Terzpe expansion. Suppose I was to differentiate this operator just once, then I'm going to look and I'm going to take one kind of variable here and contract it with another variable there. So I'm going to contract one xi with one xj in f. So since each of these lines represents one of the xi's, that's going to be drawing an edge. And I'm going to put a pij So let me try to be a bit more clear. Assume that f is some kind of sum of x1 with some constants. It's sum of x to some, to x to the power of some multi-index with some constants. So maybe I could, so this vertex with labels i1, I2, ik represents the function xi1 up to xik. So I hope this is a slightly more clear way of drawing the same thing. Some of my preparation time got sucked into studying about conversations with Davide about integrability. Now, if I'm going to differentiate xi1 up to xik with this differential operator, then I'm going to take, you know, contract them in pairs with the pij. So here, it'll be, I'll sum, when I apply this differential operator, I'm going to take one edge and contract it to some other arbitrary one. And the factor I'm going to put there is pi1, this is il, il. I'm going to sum over ways of contracting pairs of edges like that. So more generally, times xi1 to xik is given by sum . Well, suppose I want to do this exponential, then I'm going to take my little blob, which represents this vertex. I'm going to look at the sum over ways of contracting pairs of edges. Because each application of this order two differential operator contracts one pair of edges, I'm going to have some arbitrary number of applications. I contract a bunch of edges. Now, if I didn't have this, if I wasn't evaluating at zero, I might have some leftover pieces where I didn't contract all the edges. But that's, if I evaluate at zero, those terms will go away. So the thing you end up with is where you contract all of the edges in pairs and you label. And you label, if one edge was labeled by I1, if we contract a pair of edges, we put the P with the corresponding label, and we take the product of them. Okay, so this is the usual Feynman rules written in this funny way, where we see it's just differentiation. So let's consider something slightly more general. So what happens if we have like some kind of exponential? So when one studies path integrals, we're often interested in studying something like this. Now I'm going to introduce some factors of h bar. Well, an expression like this, we can just use, even though there's an exponential here, if we're going to treat this parameter as a very small parameter and expand in series in this parameter. So if you're a bit careful about expanding in series, you'll find that at each order in h-bar, there's only finitely many terms. And the same argument will tell us that this is obtained by or on the right hand side, I have a H bar next to the P because P was the inverse of A. So if I multiply A by 1 over H bar, I must multiply P by H bar for it to still be the inverse. So this expression here is going to give you the usual, it's going to give us the Feynman rules for computing integrals with an exponential in them, which is what one normally does when we study the path integral. So this kind of integral where we have, so this be a minus sign, we have a Gaussian times an exponential of something over h bar. It's what you normally study by the saddle point approximation when h bar is zero in the path integral. So what? If we apply the rules we had before to this kind of thing, you can ask what do we find? So let me write it out in a very simple case when there's only one variable, just because it makes the indices easier. So and so that we're studying say x cubed. So in this case, so this integral is now I get a h bar over 2 del x squared e 1 over 6 h bar x cubed. And we're supposed to evaluate that at x equals 0. So the rules for doing, for like the combinatorial rules for calculating this expression are so I'm going to write this guy is going to correspond to x cubed. The 1 over 3 factorial is convenient because this object has a six-fold symmetric group x. You want to think of this being as symmetric, so it's W. There's a one over graph automorphisms, which will be convenient. It'll be normalized conveniently if this is there. So e to the 1 over 6 h bar x cubed, what does this look like? Well, it looks like 1 plus this thing over h bar plus 2 for 2 such vertices. Okay. So as we go out, we notice that there's a factor. There's always a factor of 1 over h bar to the number of vertices. And there's also a factor, some combinatorial factor. The combinatorial factor is just the number of automorphisms this graph has. If it's just a vertex, well, there's the symmetric group in three letters. here, at each vertex, I can permute them, so that's 6. And I can also switch the two vertices, so that's 12. As I go off, I get some disconnected graph, which is just a bunch of vertices with some combinatorial factor. That's it? Am I incapable of multiplying? Oh, yeah, thank you. Thank you. Now, what happens if I differentiate? Well, clearly, applying, say, half del x squared means that I contract things in pairs. So, and the half is convenient because it will, if I'm doing this right, yeah, I always get getting the combinatorial factors right is a big pain, so I never. Maybe this should not have been a half. Maybe this should have been just del x squared. Okay. So for example, I'll get, if I apply it to this expression, the 1 will go away, I'll get 0, plus this thing, but now I contract it. Oh no, yeah, I think the half is right because I think what's the next one? Well, I get a sum of terms. Over, this will be over h bar squared times something. This will be over h bar squared times something. So, if we're doing this correctly, so are correct, then each connected diagram gets sent to x to the number of external lines divided by this number factorial times the number of diagram automorphisms. Actually, no, this is probably, no, just there. Yeah. So each, I mean, I think each diagram should go like that. And it's, sometimes like these normalization factors are kind of, in theory, they're the most trivial part of the whole story of Feynman diagrams, but you can get yourself super confused about the factors of two appearing in various diagrams when you're doing computations. And like, you know, you might think it's not important, but like, sometimes it's super important. Okay, so what, this is just when, no, I just wrote out what happens when I differentiate once. So what happens if I include the exponential of the whole thing? So what is e to the h bar del x squared over 2 e to the 1 over 6 h bar x cubed? Well, what I'm supposed to do is, because of this exponential, I'm going to contract an arbitrary number of pairs of vertices. So, and this guy means I have an arbitrary number of vertices. So this should be the sum over all trivial graphs gamma. Let's think about the factors of h bar. So I have some graph like this. I'm finding that there's a h bar for every edge and a 1 over h bar for every vertex. So there's a factor which is h bar to the number of edges minus the number of vertices. But if you study topology, you'll know that this is the Euler characteristic of the graph. So we'll write that as chi gamma, minus the Euler characteristic. And then I'm left with the factor of x to the number of external lines divided by the number of automorphisms of the graph. Okay. And you know, we have to think a bit to make sure we get the number of automorphisms right. So why would that appear? For instance, like the automorphisms might permute the edges. And well, there's a factorial here when I do the exponential. So I get like a 1 over n factorial when I have n edges. So that's going to account for the automorphisms permuting those edges. Yeah?
For automorphisms, do you fix the external edges?
No, I don't want to, here I don't want to fix the external edges. Because you want to say like, if you look at the graph that's like this, that'll be one of the terms, right? When I don't have any differentiation. That I want to be x cubed over 6. Okay, so what have we done? When we write an integral in this way, we see that it's convenient to think about both of these guys here and here as being the building blocks for a graph. When I have each f should be a vertex, so when I have n f's, I get n vertices. And when I differentiate them, I'm connecting those vertices. And the valency of the vertex is the degree of that polynomial. Is it a cubic polynomial? Is it a trivalent vertex? So on. And the factors of h bar are nicely arranged to give us the Euler characteristic of the graph. Now, when I evaluate at x equals 0, which is what we want to do to match the integral, then I would just set this x to 0, so I would get rid of those graphs with external lines. If I'd only graphs, no, external lines. And there's a final variant of this. Sometimes you want to consider just connected graphs and not all graphs. There's a standard thing in combinatorics that when you're counting connected things versus counting disconnected things, they're related by an exponential. So if I wanted to, that happens here too. So the thing which counts connected graphs is given by the logarithm of this expression. So similarly, I'll go to h bar because it's convenient. H bar log sum. Let's go back to the case we had before. This is the sum over connected. Trivalent graphs of the same expression, x, the number of external lines, of the automorphism group of the graph, and then the powers of h bar have shifted a little bit, because if I have a connected graph, then the Euler characteristic differs from, say, I can make a graph like this. So this graph has two vertices and two edges, so its Euler characteristic is zero. But it's always true for connected graphs that the Euler characteristic differs from the number of loops by one. So here, the factor we're finding is the number of loops. So this is like a like a loop expansion. So the part with no loops is like the trees, the tree level part. Okay. So let's move on to study, to try to think about field theory. So in field theory, we're just going to blindly apply these rules in infinite dimensions. So we're going to take it to be a manifold. And we're going to consider some field, which is a smooth function on the manifold. We'll consider the integral. Okay, So what have we done? So we've replaced Rn, a finite dimensional space whose coordinates are xi, by the space of all smooth functions on M, on the manifold. So the quadratic form xi, xj, aij is replaced by the integral over the manifold, phi times the Laplacian of phi. Now, some things get pretty confusing here because you know, before we had these xi's, which were coordinate functions on Rn, but now we're going to have the space of fields is itself the space of functions on something. So it's pretty confusing to talk about functions on functions. So I would recommend kind of forgetting that this is functions on something. It's just some huge infinite dimensional vector space. And the xi's are going to be linear functionals on this space. So things like xi become linear operators from here to 4. So quadratic polynomials in the x's become quadratic operators like this guy, integral phi phi. What are linear operators? Well, examples of them might be, I take a function, I evaluate it at a point. Or I take a function, I integrate it over some submanifold. Or I integrate it against some other function. But the most general one is phi goes to the integral d phi. That's what my name. Gamma, where gamma is a distribution on M. That is, gamma is a function with arbitrary singularities, roughly. Okay, so how would we do our Feynman rules? Well, what we did before was, when we had this quadratic form, which was Aij, we looked for some Pij, which was its inverse. So before, we found Pij such that Pij Ajk is delta ik. So what do we do in this situation? Well, here, we had a sum from j equals 1 to n. You know, we should replace that here in this more general situation by an integral. Some, say, f of p prime, which is a function on the manifold. Let's call this a of p, such that the integral. So, p prime you want this to be equal to phi. Does this equation make sense? So I want this. You want to think of this equation as just being the same as this equation, right? Because a has been replaced by the quadratic form, which takes two functions and integrates one against the Laplacian of the other. That's what's happening here. We're integrating one leg of p against the Laplacian of some arbitrary function, and what I want that to be, delta ij. So I want to take the function back to itself. So in finite dimensions, you might often draw something like this. Yeah, at least mathematicians would draw something like this. I'm contracting p with a to get the identity. And if you think about it, that's what's happening here too. Any questions? Okay, so integrating by parts, this means that the Laplacian in one variable, say P of P, must be the delta function of P is equal to P prime. This is just the infradimensional analog of finding the inverse of the quadratic form. This is so let's, so it might be helpful to pass to Fourier space for a minute, in which case everything looks just like we had before. Let's explain how to do that. It's not, it's only sort of helpful. So I assume that M is compact. We might, you know, if you want to be concrete, you can think about M being the circle. Then there are eigenvalues lambda I for the Laplacian and eigenvectors EI. So because it's compact, these, you know, if this is a non-compact manifold, these eigenvalues can accumulate, can be continuous. But in a compact manifold, things are nice. It's like these are always separated by some finite amount and they tend to infinity. So using the basis of eigenvectors, we write phi sum phi I times EI. We sum it into components. And for example, if this was the circle of the eigenvectors, you know, the Laplacian is d by d theta squared, and the eigenvectors are sine and cos, sine n theta, cos n theta. And this is just expanding a function into trigonometric functions in the kind of standard way you do in Fourier analysis. But actually, this works in any compact manifold. Of course, in a general compact manifold, you have no idea what these functions are. You just know that they exist. So in this basis, we're studying the quadratic form is some phi I lambda I phi I. So it's diagonal and just picks up the eigenvalue lambda. And the propagator is then so, you know, Eij between now I can run from 0 to infinity corresponding to the eigenvalues. So Pij must look like 1 over lambda I delta ij. A ij is lambda I delta ij. And clearly Pij ajk is delta ik. So I wrote it like this just to just to match, I mean, just to make it more concrete. Now, if we want to match with what we had there on the other side, there we wanted a function of two variables. The thing I was calling p prime is going to be the sum. I take one eigenvalue as a function of p, the other eigenvalue as a function of p prime, and I divide by lambda I. And if we were on the circle, this might be, I don't know, cos theta prime, 1 over lambda. I mean, something, if you're on the circle, you can make this completely explicit. So now let me. Oh yeah. And we have this differential equation. The Laplacian of p is a delta function. Well, why does that hold? The Laplacian in the second variable in this Fourier component language. I p prime 1 over lambda I, like by definition the Laplacian here is lambda I times that. That's sum EIP prime, and that is a delta function. Okay. So if you recall, we're doing this, we're calculating these propagators because we want to figure out how to do path integrals. But it's often going to be most useful to study the path integral on flat space. Even though the Fourier transform is much more complicated in flat space, we can just use this differential equation to calculate what the propagator has to be. So let's explain how that works. So you want some function p of, say, y prime, such that sum of delta yi squared p y prime is a delta function, y equals y prime. So you can just write these down. We'll start in dimension 1 on R. We can take p y prime to be the absolute value of the distance between them. So that, like, it's always going to be a function of the distance between the two points. So let's look at this guy. As a function of the distance, it looks like this. So if I differentiate it on this side, I get plus 1. If I differentiate it on this side, I get minus 1. When I differentiate it once. So del y p y prime. Like a delta function y less than y prime minus a delta function y bigger than y prime. That was a half. And now we differentiate it again. So here these are like step functions. The differentiation is a delta function. And here it's the same delta function, but and we pick up a sign because, you know, it's like one goes like that and the other goes like that. So when I differentiate, I get different signs, and this sign cancels out. So delta y squared y prime is equal to the delta function. Okay. So this is the equation we wanted to satisfy. So that's fun, because now you guys can study quantum mechanics using Feynman diagrams if you really wanted to. So what happens in dimension two? So here we want del y1 squared plus del y2 squared of py y prime is the delta function, it's y prime. And the solution to this equation, up to a factors of pi, which I can never remember, is y prime is equal to log. The logarithm of the absolute value of the distance. So let's maybe maybe we can briefly explain why this is true. So to prove this, we let z equals y1 plus I y2, and z bar is y1 minus I y2, and then del y1 squared plus del y2 squared. So I'm gonna drop a bunch of factors of 2 and I because I can't generate them at the board. It's like del z bar. So we're just factorizing this operator. And the logarithm up to a factor of 2, it's log z minus z prime, z bar minus z bar prime. This factorizes. Now, if we differentiate this with respect to del z and del z bar, we find del z bar of this expression. Well, I can first hit the del z on this guy, so I find del z bar 1 over z minus z prime, and then on the other side, I find plus del z 1 over z bar minus z bar prime. Now, follows from Cauchy's theorem that these guys are both delta functions, the origin, times 2 pi I. Like, clearly away from the origin, z minus z bar does not, z minus z prime does not depend on z bar. So away from the origin, this guy is zero. And away from the origin, this guy is zero. So you might ask, is it zero everywhere? But it turns out to have a delta function singularity at the origin. Let's see why that's true. It's 2 pi I. Well, we can see that by considering the integral of 1 over del z bar. Let's see. The integral along a disk of del z bar 1 over z times some function of z. Well, we get two terms, and one is a boundary term, and one comes from the possible singularities in this guy at the origin. Well, this is the, look at the boundary term, it's the contour integral, fz, and that's 2 pi I times f of 0. So we conclude that since the integral across a disk of dz bar of 1 over z is 2 pi I times f of 0, it must be that this guy is a delta function at 0. So we've now kind of checked reasonably carefully up to factors of 2 and pi, the two-dimensional propagator is the logarithm of the distance. I'll write down the n-dimensional propagator and explain how to compute the very simplest functional integrals, and then we'll stop. And I'm going to be always super lazy about getting the factors of 2 and pi right. Well, it turns out that the propagator is 1 over the absolute value of the distance times n minus 2. Over 2. So this is consistent with what we had before. If n is 1, then this... Oh, is it consistent with what we had before? No, it's not 2. If n is 1, then this is just the... We get a minus 1 power, so it goes to the top. If n is 2, this is ill-defined. So it's kind of plausible that something funny happens there, and it turns out to be the logarithm. If n is bigger than 2, well, this is what happens. So what does this tell us? So if I'm going to be, if I have a scalar field theory on Rn, so the rules we have tell us that we cook up the propagator, and then we use the propagator to differentiate these functions. From a physics point of view, it's probably best to think of, you know, 5y1 is a replacement for the coordinates x1 up to xn, but now the coordinates have a continuous index. And then we're just taking the entries out of the propagator, the pij, but here we'll be taking py1, y2. Any questions? Yeah.
How do you deal with y1 equals y2?
Well, you don't. I mean, that's tricky. mean, I would say it's a factorization algebra. It doesn't make sense to take the product of observables at overlapping points. Yes, there is a yes. Yes, but that quadrat, I mean, if I put in like phi y one squared, you would find like this is like a composite operator which requires it needs renormalization. So to deal with that, we'd have to introduce the UV cutoff and the counter term for that operator. And we would find we'd be subtracting off that singular term. I mean, one way to do it would be to use a point splitting regulator and split it into two pieces, subtract off the singular term you get, which is that, and you get zero.